research in the fundamental technologies that are going to be important for bringing robotics into more applications. So things like perception, navigation, manipulation, planning, all of those things. There are a lot of intellectual frontiers that need to be pursued on the research side. We've also, though, thought it was extremely important to develop the community that is working on things related to personal robotics. And so that's both the academic community and then, to a somewhat lesser extent, the industrial community. But part of doing science, of course, is working with the scientific community. But we've done a variety of other things to build and facilitate the community of people working on bringing this into reality. And one of the most important things that we've done is put some platforms into the world that will support work on personal robotics, both at the underlying technologies and the applications. And we've got a couple of different hardware platforms that we've worked on. The PR2 is the one that we'll talk most about today. But in addition to that, there is the what we called the TechSci when it was more of a research platform, and it's now called the Beam, and that's our remote presence device type platform, which is now a product. And then there's also a smaller robot we call the TurtleBot, and we'll see a couple of those as we walk around. And then on the software side, we think a platform is also going to accelerate work by giving people a base to work on. And on that side, we have what we call the robot operating system, which has been a widely adopted fundamental set of software capabilities that supports the development of new robotic applications and capabilities. And as a matter of fact, we have a wide range of people here, from the sort of scientific research end of the spectrum to the more engineering and development end of the spectrum, and also from the various hardware-related, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, industrial engineering, down across to software, both research and engineering. We are somewhat heavily weighted on the software side, even though probably our most famous product is the robot itself. Most of the people here are working on what's the software you need to get the robot to do things. So those are the three: research or science, building platforms, and facilitating the growth of the community, and the platforms. And then the last thing, I'll just give a brief introduction. Well, actually, let me talk about the PR2 first. So as we started thinking about a hardware platform that is that would be appropriate for sort of catalyzing work on personal robotics, we got hooked up with a couple of Stanford students, Eric Berger and Keenan Weirbeck, who were working on a personal robot as part of their PhD thesis. And they were kind of operating, they got their PhDs the old-fashioned way in robotics, which is however long it's going to take you to get your PhD, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8, 9, 10, however long it is, the first 80% you spend building your robot that is going to enable you to do whatever it is the topic of your research is. And then the last 20%, you actually get to make the robot do what it's supposed to do. You actually get to do the research. And so this is the, I don't think they had a name for it. I don't know if they had a name for it at the time they built it. But once we decided to build a second version of it, we dubbed this one the PR1 because we wanted to call the second one the PR2. So we call this the PR1. They developed it at Stanford. It's made a lot out of wood that's been laser cut. So a lot of the structural parts of it are laser cut plywood. Uses a off the shelf prosthetic gripper as the original gripper that they use. Has a couple of cameras in it, but it it pioneered a lot of basic concepts that would make a robot more appropriate to be a personal robot. So the counterbalancing in the arms, plus the sort of allows them to use relatively weak motors and still be able to lift things. But all the motors are designed to be back drivable, so that essentially the robot can't hurt you with its arms, not by pushing against you. Now, we do caution people with the PR2 that if you put a knife in the gripper, that in fact we can't be held responsible for what it's going to do. So we avoid saying these things are safe, but there are a variety of things about the way they're designed that are designed to make them safer than, significantly safer than industrial robots. So after Eric and Keenan got their PhD, we invited them to come here and do a second version of the robot, which we could make in larger quantities and then try and get out into the research population so that future researchers wouldn't have to take the route that they did and spend 80% of their time building the platform and then just 20% of their time doing the research. And so that we dubbed the PR2. In many ways, the design was pioneered. This is kind of a breadboard version of this. This is the alpha version of the PR2. We'll see several PR2s operating. Henry will be operating one of them for you. We'll see the lab where they're built. This was the alpha version. You can see it's got a lot of cameras in the head. It's got a scanning laser on a tilt sled for generating point clouds. It's got now the arms are made out of metal instead of wood. We redid the grippers. Apparently, we needed a prescription to get the actual prosthetic gripper.
Autobot Greifer hand. From Germany, and actually I used them over at the VA for our robotics work as well. So okay. It was pretty common at the time.
So we redid the gripper, and now we're actually working on some new ideas for new gripper technology as well. So you'll see a little bit more when you go back and see the Robots for Humanity demo, a little bit more about the capabilities of the PR2. So the last thing I'll say out here, and then we'll walk around, is at the point. So I guess one last thing. This is the alpha version. We built two or three of these, and then we went into beta production of the PR2s. And essentially, that's what you'll see. And we had a beta test program where we gave away 11 of these to mostly universities, all research labs. I think 10 of the 11 were university research labs, to get them into use and to support the personal robotic technology development. Since then, we've actually sold another 25 or 30 to other research labs. Again, mostly academic institutions, but a few commercial research labs. After we started shipping them, CNN did a news story on them. As you say, everybody loves robots, and so and CNN loves anything that everybody loves. So they did a story on the PR2. And Henry Evans, who's a quadriplegic, I don't know if you've given Henry's background.
I mentioned a little bit about him.
Yeah, so yeah. I think when he was 40, he had a brainstem stroke, and that left him a quadriplegic. And he, so he watched a lot of TV, and he saw this show on CNN, and he said, you know what, that would be really useful to me. Because he has enough ability that he can run a computer interface. And so he said, well, if you can run one of these things off a computer, I could have this doing things for me. And so he got in touch with Charlie Kemp at the university, or at Georgia Tech, and who was doing, who CNN was interviewing, and said, you know, I think this would be an interesting thing to do. Henry's a remarkable guy, as you'll find out. And so we decided that it would be a good thing to collaborate. So there's a three-way collaboration between Willard Raj, Georgia Tech, and Henry to develop technologies that will be useful for people that don't have full use of their own body to have the robots help out. So you're going to hear a lot more about that from Matei, Kaijin, and Henry about that. So any questions before? So I'm going to take you in two places. I'm going to show you the lab where we build the PR2s, and then we'll walk around a little bit and see where people program them, and then we're going to go into another room where they're set up to do Henry's demos. Yeah?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. How heavy of something can this robot pick up?
I think that each arm is something like 2 kilograms.
Okay.
So not super heavy.
And then why does the beta have cameras on the arm as well?
We thought that would be helpful in terms of gripping, right, in grasping things. That you got something that's going to go along with the gripper, so that you're not going to get occlusion from other things. To tell you the truth, I don't think they use it as much as they thought they were going to. But it is used some in terms of doing the perception for the manipulation and grasping. One of the things that's changed the most, that we've learned the most about since these were originally designed, is the sensors for perception. And in fact, you'll see we designed in a lot of different things because we knew that we didn't know what was going to be the most useful. Turns out one of the more expensive things about this robot is this suite of cameras up here, and we don't use them at all anymore. You'll see when we get to the PR2s, they all have a Kinect mounted on the top, right? And so that gives us good 3D RGB data, actually in the most recent ones built, we just put dummies in here because there are holes in the faceplate, so we got to put something in there, but there are dummies. I think they still do put cameras in here, and they do use it a little bit, but not as they weren't sure exactly how much they'd use.
And then I guess I was wondering how much one of these would cost, because obviously for becoming a personal robot,
yes.
It would have to.
Yes, and so this one will never be a personal robot. This lists for, well, actually the version that's the next version from this lists for $400,000. We've sold almost all of them at a 30% discount for $280,000, because we'll offer you a discount as long as you're a participant in the open source community. And basically, if you're willing to put the software that you develop for whatever it is you're working on in this into the open source, then we give you a 30% discount. And I think all but one of the robots have been sold under those conditions. And again, the idea is to foster the community, foster the growth of the technology. So, for example, you may have seen there's one of these at the rival institution across the bay, where they're looking at laundry-related tasks and folding towels and things. And so a lot of the software that they develop, not just that application, but some of the underlying things that will be more generally useful, they've put back as open source so that other people can use them, other institutions can use them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we're going to go out this door, and the first place we're going to go is what we call the light lab, which is where we build the PR2. So you see a few with the covers off. That's essentially a create base on the bottom, which is a Roomba without the vacuum. And then a Kinect and a computer, and it's this one's a very low cost robot. Doesn't do any manipulation in and of itself. You can mount a variety of things on the top, and so some people have mounted arms on it. But it's a very much lower cost way to get into robotics, and it runs basically the same software as the PR2. And so one of the things it's good for is giving you a way to get into programming robots in a much easier way. So a lot of these are sold into the education market, but there are a whole variety of things. One of the great things about getting things out in the real world is you can't predict what people are going to do with them. That's one of the reasons that we want to get more robots out in the world, is that we learn from what people do with them. This is where we assemble PR2s, and you can see a couple of them in different states of assembly. Here's a chassis with just the basic spine attached. No casters, no batteries, no computers. Here's one a little bit more advanced. It has the basic arm mechanisms attached. It's got the head. It's got two good-sized computers in it. The rest of the base is packed with batteries. Four holonomic casters on the bottom, so so it can kind of move in any direction easily. So no grippers on this one yet, and obviously no covers. Actually, this one's fairly far advanced. I was thinking it was, but without the covers, you just see so much more. And then there's one back there you can see that's nearing the final stages, so it's got all of the covers on and the grippers. So a lot of the parts we get made by outside contract houses, and then we're essentially an assembly operation here. We have a laser cutter, we have a 3D printer in another room. We use those mainly for prototyping new types of things. And then eventually once we figure out what we want, we send it out and get somebody to make it for us. That's what a partially assembled PR2 looks like.
How long does it take to put one together?
I think they work on them in a little bit in parallel. I think they've got it. I think calendar time between when they start and when they finish, I think, is on the order of a couple of weeks. Okay. But I think they'll do a batch of four or five in that time. So they're working on them kind of serially in parallel, kind of staggered.
And it's all handmade.
Yes, it's all hand assembled. That's right. Obviously, there's a lot of bent sheet metal in this that is made outside, but our operation is all skilled technicians.
What's the breakdown between labor costs to put this together versus material costs?
Very heavily weighted on material. Material. The labor cost is actually not that great, could be even less. We probably have overqualified technicians at this point for doing the assembly, but we're happy to have them, because as we move to newer things, it really pays to have really highly skilled technicians.
How many people do you have working here?
Well, in the in the whole building, we have 55 or 60. It's only about four or five of them work here in the white lab now. It used to be a bit more when we were at a higher production rate, but they're mostly software developers and researchers, and then some mechanical, electrical, engineering researchers and developers.
Are you hiring?
We are, particularly double E's, particularly power double E's. Any power double E's, come see us. We also have an internship program, there are a variety of projects that are looking for interns. Again, mostly on the software side, but some on the hardware side. Okay, we'll go out this door here. We're going to walk through what's called the green room, which is where a lot of the software development goes on, and then we'll go over to the cathedral, and I will turn you over to Robots for Humanity.
here's the cafeteria. Could be important for some.
Oh, yeah.
And then here's where a lot of the things to do experiments and
moving.
And then lots of computers and screens and that sort of stuff. So this is the green room, and if you'll come through here, we'll from beginning to end is about 2 weeks, but they're building several at the same time. So I think there are some steps in there that you couldn't really compress, but they don't take kind of full time. Okay, so this is the end of my my portion of the show. I'm going to turn you over to the Robots for Humanity project. Haijin Zhao is one of our researchers, and Matei Giancarlo. I think of them as Haijin and Matei, but in these formal settings, the two main researchers on this end who are working on Robots for Humanity. John Weiss has just recently started working on the project. And then Henry Evans is one of the major collaborators on it, and Jane Evans is a key part of the support project. So they're going to tell. I told you just a little bit about how this got started from the CNN show, but they're going to tell you much more about what they're doing.
Okay. Well, if you're on your way out, we'd like to thank you for hosting us.
Always fun to talk about what we do. That's a fun place.
Okay. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. My name is Henry Evans. Professor Jaffe asked me to describe our program to you. But first, I have a bone to pick. Why do I always get the afternoon slot when everyone is half asleep? You try to wake everybody up. I will tell a joke about college students. Okay, so how many Stanford engineering students does it take to change a light bulb? Well, it takes 10. One to hold the light bulb, and none to drink until the room spins. Okay, so how many Stanford engineering students does it take to change a light bulb? Okay, so how many Stanford engineering students does it take to change a light bulb? I'm not sure if that woke anybody up, but let me tell you about Robots for Humanity. A couple of years ago, I was watching CNN, and I saw Dr. Kim for the PR2 robot. I immediately imagined using it as a surrogate for my own body. I emailed the company and, to my surprise, they answered right away and said they were starting a collaboration with Dr. Kim and asked me to co-collaborate. What I am going to demonstrate today is a remote manipulation project. I will ask the robot to retrieve the treasure from a secret cache and hand it to Professor Jaffe.
Oh.
I will do this simply by moving my head. My head motions will command the robot to locate the cache and grab the treasure. Everybody ready?
Okay. Young two,
are you ready?
Yes, when I wake up from last week.
well, Henry fairly operates the robot. We do what he said. Kaijin and myself get to know you a little bit about how this works, about the interface. So what you're seeing here is exactly what Henry's seeing on the screen. This is the interface that he uses to control the robot. And the way this works, this device on the laptop is tracking a reflective dot on Henry's lap. So by moving his head, he can move the mouse cursor on the screen. What's neat is that this plugs in directly to USB, and the computer just makes the mouse, so it controls the mouse. And then Henry has an actual mouse in his left hand, and with his residual movement in his left thumb, he can click the button. So he essentially has a one-button mouse that he can use to interact with the computer. He uses that to surf the web, to write emails, and so on. And in this particular instance, he's using it to control this interface, which in turn controls the PRQ. So this interface that you're seeing here is based on what we call RVIS, which stands for Robot Visualization. It's an engine for visualizing data from a robot, part of RUN, part of the robot operating system. And in the Robot for Humanity project, as part of this, we've converted it from a visualization engine into an interaction. So Henry can not only see what the robot's seeing, but also issue commands. So in particular, here, what you see is that you've got two views of the world. On the left, in the top left corner, is the view from the camera, from the Kinect that's on the robot's head. And on the right-hand side is a 3D view populated by the robot model and by the point cloud from the Kinect. And they're both very important because the camera view is nice, but camera view is easy for us to interpret as people. For the teleoperator, you just see a camera view, you immediately know what's going on. But the camera view is limited in that, obviously, you cannot look at the scene from multiple angles. You can only see from whatever the camera happens to be. The 3D view is great because the virtual camera, you can move it around, and you can look at the scene from multiple angles. So some of the biggest problems that you have when controlling the robot and teleoperating the robot, one of them is this fact that you have a two-dimensional input device, a mouse, and a two-dimensional, essentially, feedback device, a monitor, plus a 3D world that you need to interact with. So this ability to move the virtual camera around and look at a scene from multiple angles is very important in that respect. And one of the games that we play a lot in this project is how can the teleoperator, in this case Henry, have good environmental awareness of what's going on around the robot, and how can the teleoperator issue commands, complex commands that the robot can execute using the simple interface. So this is one of the critical things about this. So now what Henry is doing, he has driven the robot to the cabinet, and now he wants to open the door. And in order to open the door, what he did is he specified where he wanted the robot to go. Moving the robot arm around is relatively difficult task. The robot arm has 7 individual joints, right? So it operates in a 7-dimensional space. That's a difficult task to do as a teleoperator, to move each joint independently to get the vehicle to where you want it to be, especially if you don't want to be hitting anything in the environment. So what we're trying to do is use autonomy and use intelligence in the robot controllers to make it easier for the operator. So now that Henry has grasped the handle, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the tool in a second, but Henry's going to use it again, now he wants to open the door. And essentially what he's doing now, he is telling the robot where the hinge is. This control here, he moves it on top of the hinge. And by moving it on top of the hinge, then a simple rotation motion, right, you're telling the robot, now I just want to rotate around the hinge, so then the robot is driving an arc and opens the door. And in the right-hand image, the point cloud doesn't show that yet, because the point cloud doesn't update continuously. What you see on the left side is the camera image, which does update continuously, then the cabinet isn't yet open. And now Henry is updating the point cloud, and you'll be able to see in a second that indeed the cabinet is open. So now you're seeing kind of the second part of the game for us. So right, the first part was environmental awareness and the ability to issue complex commands through a simple interface. The second part is controlling, using levels of autonomy and using intelligence in the software to make it easier for the operator to do relatively complex tasks. So now inside the cabinet is a stash of Willow Garage logo services. And Henry's going to go ahead and grab one of them. Here the solution. So, and for that, again, you could joint by joint tell the operating arm all the way to get them. That's a complex motion that you have to execute, especially if you're trying to avoid collisions along the way. So instead, Henry is using the tool that we call gripper click, which allows you to essentially just tell the system where he wants the gripper to go. So now, I want to grab something. So now he's right clicking on the on what he wants to grab, and he's essentially telling the system where he wants the gripper to go. And now the robot is attempting to compute a collision-free path to get the gripper over there in a way that doesn't collide with the environment and that allows grabbing the object. So let's do it.
So is it also a matter of lighting as well? Yeah. Okay.
So now,
Squished and bounced out.
Oh, well, now we're not seeing it anymore. So just
push the
forward, move the arms aside. And now you're seeing another problem that you have a lot. And by the nature of things, when you're manipulating objects in the environment, very often you are occluding them from the senses, right? Human arms are nice and slender, we can see around them. The robot arm is pretty big. So now the arm is in the way, which means the robot cannot see anymore. So in order to get there, and we have to get the arm out of the way, we can refresh the point cloud and then try it again.
Yeah, the gripper got it, but it's kind of squished and it's not stuck.
Right. In terms of grasping ability. Because the gripper is a fertile way for it. Somewhat simple, it's very robust, and it's very good at precise grasp. It doesn't have the kind of dexterous ability that tactile sensing that you can have. The human hand there, you just, you know, touch the object a little bit, at a subconscious level, you can then adapt. You can correct the motion, you can correct the finger posture, and you grab your object. Did you refresh the point on everything?
Yeah, you did.
So the thing is, when we were talking about PR tools for jobs in our body, a question came up of that noticed the forearm cameras. And I said that I thought that it was partly because, you know, we were anticipating this occlusion problem, but that was I correct in thinking that you don't use them as much as you thought you might?
We do use them actually when teleoperating oftentimes. Part of the problem is screen real estate. So you can see here with the Suzy, it's really pretty fast. But, you know, for fine movements, once you've got in there and you're trying to read into things that you can't see beyond the occlusion, we do often bring a forearm camera and, in fact, we have it move where it rotates it. If it's not rotated, it's kind of fizzy and so then you kind of does this all the time. But rotated up, then you can just see kind of from the forearm point of view what's inside of the thing that you're seeing in your mind.
So broadcast this position against the curve of the virtual gripper is not correct. Just broadcast it this position.
So pretty much only the forearm camera when we're trying to do very low-level movements, just fake rotation movements, because it's not a stereo camera, and so most of our time is us and it's kind of relying on 3D information. The robot knows where the camera is. Whereas just the mono camera, the human can interpret it mostly see, although it's hard to get some feedback. But it's still useful for us, but most of our time is us, just can't see.
Question over here.
So then this is on the right side of the pre-made environment, right? How does it function in like a strange environment, like something that's not pre-rendered?
Oh, that you're seeing on the right is not pre-rendered.
It's not pre-rendered?
It's just coming from his head. Oh. The top of his head.
Okay.
The robot doesn't actually have a view of the world. In fact, the reason this is so hard, what he's doing right now, is because the robot doesn't have to model the world. It's just seeing a point cloud from his neck, which is an picture of things, and it doesn't see the backside of things. And so it's relying a lot on, you know, Henry has to transpose because the robot doesn't understand really what's out there in the world.
Okay.
There's a lot of tiny things that we put if we had a full model.
The robot's being rendered.
Oh, the robot. The robot's being rendered based on its RAM. So it has a perfect sentence sense from all of its encoders. So it knows its pose, all of its arms and joints.
So it's being, so the rendered robot is being superimposed on the point cloud from the
internet. I have a question. It seems like since last year you made a lot of advances with the user interface. Was it actually advantageous for you to work with Henry and get a better sense of his needs that would translate into a better user interface for everybody?
Actually, Henry is much better at using our graphics interface than many able-bodied people because he's got really great community understanding and so on from us. And so, in some sense, if Henry were an able-bodied boy, blind person, then he'd probably do about the same as we use in our primary texture. But we also have improvements just because Henry has a lot of buttons and so on. Henry has helped us a lot to refine the possessions.
And one of the things we really went for is generality, right? We didn't want to hard code certain tasks, so So that's a lot of things that this summer we did a couple of proof of concept demonstrations at Henry's place, where Henry got the drink from the fridge or a towel from the drawer. And in both of those cases, we didn't try those in a friend. Do you want to plug the robot, John?
Yeah.
Right. We just went up to Henry's place, and from like the first attempt or the second attempt, Henry was able to do complex manipulation tasks. Yeah. That's a very good question. Not really, right? But now we are mostly relying on the operator to have the tape in their head and to remember what the arms are doing at all times. And what makes it more difficult is that it's kind of hard to tell like this. The Kinect has much, much narrower field of view than the human eye, right? We have so much better environmental awareness than you have as much as one of the robot. When you're manipulating, it's very rare that you see what the other arm is doing. But we've been talking about, we've been thinking about what kind of cues we can give the operator that things are happening. Maybe you can blink the side of the screen red if the arm is hitting something over there. How do you know if the arm is hitting something? Well, either you have, there's a laser on the robot's chest, you see the obstacle, so maybe you see that, right? Or maybe it's something you don't see at all, but you just realize that the arm isn't what it should be. Right, the joint encoder knows at all times where the arm is. If the motor is not commanding the arm to go somewhere and the arm is there, it probably needs to stay somewhere. So then we can try to think how we can give cues to the operator about that. The flip side is that if you just throw out cues on the screen at all times, you just overload the system completely, and then the operator cannot make sense of anything. So how do you give the operator environmental awareness without overloading the encoder? And that's one of the key difficulties for user interfaces for this
robot. That probably would be not overloaded
to add to the limitation that regulation is. How much should I cheat?
And again, this is a kind of complex mobile manipulation task involving no navigation, opening doors, or grasping from already constrained and cluttered environment. And it's something that, on this particular cabinet, we have to practice, right? It's not like the one and only cabinet will ever work.
I didn't do anything. It was all PR. Sue and Henry. Thank you, Henry.
Does the Kinect only operate on the visible light spectrum? Can it see in the dark?
Interestingly, the point cloud that the Kinect produces is using infrared. So the way that works, the Kinect projects a pattern onto the scene from a light source, and then sees it from a camera. And since the light source and the camera are not co-located, from that it's able to triangulate and project. But that pattern is in infrared, so that it's not annoying for kids playing Kinect games, right? So the depth camera has infrared, can see in infrared part of the spectrum. The color image is just
infrared. Which means that on the right, you could actually sort of see what's going on by rotating around trying to get a 3D picture, but all the points are black.
So there's no layer on of big color spectrum. Visually show the false image direction.
Okay. So, yes, like you mentioned, we have a whole bunch of other more autonomous capabilities in the system, like, for example, autonomous navigation around the building. We have a map of the building, and then you can just send the robot somewhere and the other side of the building. It'll just navigate autonomously, avoiding obstacles along the way, static obstacles or dynamic obstacles. We have autonomous grasping capabilities, object recognition capabilities. And those are all great, except that they don't work all the time. So if you want a robot to do general purpose mobile manipulation in a system for Henry, for example, you need the entire spectrum from autonomy to less autonomy to very operator intensive lower level system. And what we've shown you today isn't all the way to the lowest level to everything and everything. It isn't the robot autonomous. It's somewhere in the middle, and the slider keeps moving up and down depending on the task and depending on the environment.
Throughout the operation, there's been this thing on the front, I want to say, like the robot's throat that's rocking up and down. What's that? Is that the...
It's a laser rangefinder. And it's generating a separate 3D map of the environment from the Kinect. So here, to the right, you can see the Kinect point cloud. And, okay, do you want to activate the mind sphere?
Yeah. I'm going to scale control from there for a little bit.
The mechanic's going to activate the mind sphere, and that's what the motion planner is doing, which includes an off map generated by the laser rangefinder. So it has a much wider field of view than the Kinect. But it's a little bit of operator overload to have it on all the time.
So let me see what the best
also, if you notice, Henry is often reporting that they wouldn't have experience because the aftermath that's generated sometimes doesn't quite clear it all the way, so someone should walk in front of the robot. And then sometimes there are these curious points here and there, and the robot doesn't know how to tell whether there's actually curious obstacles there or whether it's safe to go. And so the human, of course, can see that it's safe to go, and so the human can clear it and say, like, no, really, just go. But not always. For instance, I was at Henry's house, and we were operating the robot, and there were spurious points, I thought, in my cost map. And I was like, robot, just go, just go. And it wouldn't go, it wouldn't go. I kept clearing it, it wouldn't go, it wouldn't go. And finally, I realized that those spurious points were robot's last table. So I was actually quite lucky that the robot knew and did not go.
So this is what the laser rangefinder sees. And it's not as high resolution as the Kinect. There's no color information, but it's a lot wider field of view. Which is great because, you know, it's not good if you want to have semantic information about what's there, if you want to recognize objects. From the laser data, it's going to be really, really hard. The semantic information is very hard to get. We use the Kinect for that. But for just knowing obstacles, there's something there and I shouldn't get it, this data is great. And when Henry, for example, says reset, this thing goes away and then the laser rebuilds it. Right? And then what Henry just asked me to share is that, so this is one part of the Robots for Humanity project. Like Dave mentioned, and Henry mentioned, this is a collaboration between Willa Garage and Professor Kemp at Georgia Tech, and also Professor Bill Smart at Oregon State. And at Willa, we focus on enabling Henry to interact with the environment. Our friends at Georgia Tech focus on enabling Henry to interact with his own body. So what they did is they built an interface and they did tools which allowed Henry to scratch his face and to shave his face. And then part of debugging and testing that system, they have Henry log in remotely using the web browser interface and try out all the software on a robot that works at Georgia Tech. So Henry, from his home in the Bay Area, shaved Professor Kemp in Atlanta. So we're pretty sure that was a world first when they touched the robot.
Does anybody have any final questions for Henry or World Garage folks? If there's no other questions, then the class would really like to thank Henry and World Garage for having us and seeing how far we've come, you know, this past year. It's really been amazing. And it's good to see you healthy and well. So thank you again. Go back home. Maybe you can take a quick look up here if you want to get it really close.
No riding, so.